May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Tracy Oldemeyer with the Klein Williams Law Firm in Fort Collins, Colorado, attorney registration number 28246. I represent the appellant, Loveland Essential Group, LLC. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal.
That's fine. I'll try and keep an eye on your time for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The detailed facts of this case are fully set forth in the appellant's opening brief, in particular at pages 1 through 18. For purposes of my argument, I'd like to focus on the very straightforward facts related to the key legal issues on appeal. My client was the buyer of commercial property in Loveland, Colorado. The seller were the appellees and cross appellants, the Grauman defendants. There's also tenants involved who will not be here today arguing pursuant to a recent advisement filed with the court. My client entered into a letter of understanding with the Grauman defendants to purchase this commercial property. At the time they entered into that letter of understanding, the Grauman defendants, and in particular Mr. Gary Grauman, made an oral representation with respect to a portion of the property, a building in which a sports bar was operated, that the tenant occupied that paying $2,800 per month, that the lease was month to month, and there was no written lease. Subsequent to that letter of understanding that was executed in early March 2006, the buyer and the seller entered into a real estate purchase agreement and an asset purchase agreement. Both were represented by counsel at this time. There was no mention in either document that there was a written lease governing the tenant in the bar property. The sale actually started on May 2, 2006, and a warranty deed that concluded the process was executed by the seller on May 10, 2006. In the warranty deed, a written lease with the bar tenant was not carved out as an exception to the covenant against encumbrances. Prior to that closing, however, on May 8th, the buyers first learned of the potential for a written lease governing the tenant in the bar property. And that was through an oral statement Jen Jara, one of the tenants, gave the buyers. Subsequent to that, the buyers demanded from seller to see the written lease. It was faxed the next day, May 9th. At that point and thereafter, buyers have always challenged the lease. The claims that the buyer makes in this case against the seller relate to breach of the real estate purchase agreement, specific provisions requiring the seller to transfer title free and clear of encumbrances, breach of the asset purchase agreement, and then breach of the warranty deed. The key factual issue in this case is the existence of the lease, the fact that it exists, not when it was disclosed or how many times Mr. Grauman tried to disclose it. It's that the lease existed, yet the contracts obligated the seller to do something very different. There was a written lease governing that portion of the property, the bar property, when there was not supposed to be one.
Oldemeyer, yes. Let's get right to the issue. As I understand it, what you're appealing is inadequate damages.
Correct. The trial court awarded zero damages for the, we prevailed on liability on breach of the two contracts and the warranty deed.
It is unclear to me what you contend the proper measure of damages is. Throughout your brief, you refer to the downtown parking case. At one case, you even say, per that case, the correct measure of damages is the fair rental value of the property. But that's what the court gave you. So I take it that's not what you contend you should have gotten. So what specifically do you think the measure should have been?
Your Honor, that is the heart of this appeal. The downtown parking case, the Tibbetts case, and I think it's the Evans versus Fott case are all cases that the allegation was breach of a warranty deed, the covenant against encumbrances. Here, our case is a little bit different. We had not only the warranty deed, but also two additional contracts and additional language in those contracts, including contracts and the indemnification language awarding the buyer certain damages, or that they could recover damages under that provision against the seller for breach of the warranties. And so the distinguishing mark in all those cases is those relate specifically to damages when the sole allegation is breach of a covenant against encumbrances in a warranty deed.
But here, the other provisions you're claiming are breached are covenants against encumbrances. They're just in different documents, but it's the nature of the covenant's exactly the same. So why should the measure of damages be different?
It's for general breach of contract damages. Put the buyer in the position it would have occupied, but for the breach.
All right, and that's what I want to talk about. Okay, mm-hmm. We can all agree that that's kind of the general measure of a breach of contract damages for any contract. But again, I'm unclear as to what you contend it was here. It seems to me in a real property case that that measure is, if anything, different than what downtown parking says, and I'm not sure it is, mm-hmm. That it would be the difference in what you paid for the property versus what you would have paid with the encumbrance on it. You see what I mean?
The
diminished value measured in that way, the difference in what a ready, willing buyer would have paid.
Correct.
Okay, is that what you're contending here?
There's lots of ways that issue can be addressed. Before I respond specifically to that, in this instance, we had a unique factual scenario because the validity of the lease was always challenged by the buyer. We never accepted the lease. Part of the reason we had to go to trial was to determine, is that lease even valid? In the other cases, like downtown parking and Tibbetts and the others, the measure of damages was almost by acquiescence determined to be the amount that the buyer was able to pay the tenant to remove that encumbrance.
But Ms. Oldemeyer, that makes your case perhaps factually different, but ultimately, Judge Lammons concluded that there was a valid lease. So given that, how do you think that damages should be determined?
Your Honor, we think it should be the general breach of contract damages. And even though this is a real property case, we're talking about the fact that the buyer did not get what the buyer bargained for. And Mr. Foster talked about the damages to the buyer as a result of not getting what they bargained for. They bargained for property that they intended to develop.
Well, let me pin you down here, because this is what I really don't understand. It seems to me the expert testimony here on your side had to do with, oh, well, we would have developed the property, and this is how much we would have made from developing the property. That seems to me to be qualitatively different from saying, well, we would have paid an amount less for the property, which is, I think, if you look at the benefit of the bargain, what you're saying is we want the difference between the value of the property with and without the encumbrance. But this lost profits from the development thing seems to me to be something different. Did you present any testimony as to this difference in the purchase price, this difference in the value of the property?
Specifically, the buyer testified, and I believe it was Mr. Randy Jackson testified, we did not get what we bargained for. Did he speak of it in terms of dollars and cents? No. But what the evidence presented on that issue was, tenant was going to elect to remain in that property, exercise the option to renew. And therefore, to remove the encumbrance, you have to remove tenant. If tenant's willing, buy them out. Mr. Foster, in Exhibit 52, there's a one-page addendum where he talks about relocation costs of the tenant, costs to buy out the tenant. And again, those are also addressed in the other cases where what would the tenant expect to be bought out from their rights under this lease? And that is the fair rental value through the end of the lease term.
But aren't those cases involving situations where either the owner of the property has a unilateral right to terminate the lease or has in fact paid the tenant to terminate the lease? And we don't have either of those here.
Right. The tenant said, I'm going to stay.
So those cases, it seems to me, are not very helpful here. We just don't have those facts. We have different facts. The tenant who won't leave and can't be made to leave.
And that's buyer's frustration. Buyer is stuck now.
But what's the evidence of damages in that situation? That's what I'm getting at.
In this situation, Your Honor, other than the diminished value, which we've addressed, and I talked about Wes Foster and then his addendum, what the tenant might demand to remove, what a buyer, from looking at my client, the buyer put the property back on the market, what a prospective buyer might pay for that property, it's what's it going to cost to remove that encumbrance? What's it going to take to get the tenant to
move? Saying that's the same measure of damages? What it takes to remove the encumbrance is the same measure as the diminished value of the property? You're saying those are the same?
In the two cases, downtown parking and Tibbetts, they were able to pay that amount to the tenant, not a little bit more.
I'm trying to figure out what you're saying. We're all trying to figure out what exactly what you're saying the measure of damages ought to be in this case. Is it the amount it takes to get the Jarrahs off the property? Or is the amount the diminished value of the property if it's put up for resale? Or are they the same?
It actually might be one and the same, Your Honor. We bargained for unencumbered property. We're stuck with this encumbered property.
What was the evidence as to how much it would cost to get the Jarrahs off the property?
That's in Wes Foster's appraisal, and that is his calculation. It's a one-page cost of relocation, which was estimated, I believe, between $85,000 and $100,000.
It's Exhibit 52.
52, and it's a lengthy document. I think it's page 370.
Said it was a one-page document. I just said so.
Within his lengthy report. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Exhibit 52 is the detailed report. Got it.
And there's a one-page addendum within that exhibit.
All right.
But given the testimony that they weren't going to leave,
mm-hmm.
period.
Right.
Well, what relevance is that to the measure of damages?
Because now we had to deal with this tenant who is adversarial. We had all of the issues related to protective orders, going to court, trying to reduce hostilities. The parking lot, even under the lease, they assert they had non-exclusive use of that parking lot in an effort to reduce frustrations. We had to put up a chain link fence and boulders. Ultimately, all that evidence was before the court as to the efforts made by the buyer to deal with the tenant in that adversarial situation. And so that's, you know, that evidence is all before the court, Your Honor. The expenses the buyer incurred to keep the peace with the tenant, in addition to the costs incurred to challenge the validity of the lease.
Ms. Oldemeyer, you wanted to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. You're down to a little over three.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll wrap it up here briefly and save my additional 3 minutes, but the measure of damages goes to the very heart of this case. And if the court determines that the measure of damages is the diminished value of the property, as Judge Richman indicated, it's a combination of what we would have paid had we known versus what we did pay, and what would it take to remove the tenant, remove the encumbrance, in addition to the consequential and other damages that flow therefrom. We had a right to challenge the validity of the lease. Ultimately, Judge Lammons didn't agree with us, but the costs associated with challenging that, and again, there's evidence in the record of that as well that we cite on pages 24 and 25 of our brief. The cost of relocating the tenant we've already talked about. So that's the measure of damages. There's a second point in our appellate brief, and that relates to the very deferential standard applicable to the fraud claim that we assert. We do recognize that it is a very high standard of review, very deferential. However, for the reasons we articulated in our brief and the facts that are detailed, and in particular in our reply brief to the Jarrahs, there is sufficient evidence from which the court can conclude that there is clear error and that the case should be remanded for a trial on the fraud claim. Thank you.
Thank you. You have about a minute and a half left. Good afternoon.
Well, I don't usually do this.
Excuse me. Could you identify yourself, please?
Excuse me. Eric Fisher on behalf of the Appalese.
Thank you.
While I don't normally look at a broad picture, the court absolutely needs to consider the arguments of the appellant in this case and really the issues that came up as it related to the alleged breaches. If the court is going to accept that there was a breach of a contract after disclosure was fully made before closing, then the court is in fact saying that the buyers, with full knowledge of every single item, could have forced my client to close under the contract. So if my client shows up and says, I'm not going to close, and that's the testimony in this case, I'm not going to close unless you accept the lease, they could have sued him for specific performance to close and then sued him again for damages, because that's really what they're saying. If you take this downtown parking case, you just have to distinguish it, which the judge did not in the trial court. Because there is no question and no other interpretation of the evidence other than Mr. Grauman, when this issue was raised, said, I mailed you the lease. The court found the lease was mailed. But now that you've got it, I'm not going to close unless you accept this lease. The appellants sent notice to the title company. Do not close until we instruct you further because we have a title defect. And what did they do? They instructed the title company to close. Not under this fantasy, under protest. They instructed them to close with complete and full knowledge. So, forgetting everything else, and I think the facts are clear. The buyers drafted this contract. The simple fact is the contract upon which the court-based liability did not apply to the bar property. There were two distinct parcels. So they want to rewrite the contract to include both. The asset purchase agreement, by its terms, did not apply to the real estate. The court made a mistake there. And the question of the warranty deed. At the time the government signed the warranty deed again, everything was disclosed. With that, I also want to talk to you and didn't
there was there here. Is a warranty that there's no encumbrances, and in fact there was a written encumbrance, correct?
Sure. There was known to everybody.
Okay.
So I mean if you're gonna say that the buyers can ignore the fact that they have every single piece of information regarding that lease, and my client still signed the warranty deed and then becomes liable, and there's no waiver. And I would argue that the Campbell versus Summit Plaza case we have cited to you indicates it's a clear waiver by closing with full knowledge. And that's my point. Because in downtown parking, they didn't have full knowledge. In this case, they did. The other issue, and of course we agree with the judge, the damages that the appellants seek or the retrial is completely speculative. This court is correctly. Because the testimony was is the tenants weren't moving. So it's speculative to say what it would have cost for them to move. I mean, that's irrelevant. We presented evidence at trial through two separate experts as to what the highest and best use and the value of the property was at the time of the alleged breach. That is not what they presented. And both of those experts said there was no damage. In fact, there was a net benefit in that market because of the lease. Another issue deals with this, we were going to develop. There's no evidence that they were going to develop the property. That's completely speculative.
Mr. Fisher, there was some mention in the briefs that with regard to the issue of development, that the Lover and the Central Group couldn't develop as long as the sports bar was there. Was there any testimony or other evidence as to why that was so, or why they couldn't develop the RV park and not the sports bar property?
In fact, on cross-examination, there was evidence, you know, because I asked them and asked their expert if you could develop this in phases. We also asked them if they'd taken a single step towards development. Both of those questions were answered in the points I'm making today. Development's a fantasy. They were not going to develop this property.
But did you say
we could have applied in the city, and all the experts agreed it takes 2 to 3 years of process to even begin the development before you can break ground.
So are you saying that there was testimony that they could have developed the property in phases?
Yes. Yeah, their expert on cross-examination admitted that. I think think if this court, again, you know, you can't have it both ways. There is no question that the real estate purchase agreement only applies to the parcel that does not contain the barn. It's also clear pursuant to that contract that there is no time frame upon which the encumbrances had to be disclosed. In the process of the contract, they want to rely on for a breach requires them to make an objection, which they did, and then requires that objection to be resolved, which it was because they accepted it. They authorized the title company to close. The clear terms of the asset purchase agreement clearly relate to personal property, not to the real estate. You would not need two agreements to cover everything. The judge just was, I guess, inexperienced in real estate. Because if you review section 1.1 of the asset purchase agreement, it relates to personal property. It does not relate to the real property. That's in the real estate purchase agreement. The warranty deed we've discussed. The last thing I want to talk about is this, again, diminished value. There was no evidence presented by the appellants as to any diminished value. Wes Foster did not testify that based upon the lease at the time of the breach that the property was worth any less money. There was not a single piece of evidence related to that. The only thing he did testify is, again, the speculation as to what it might cost to move the tenants when we know the tenants' position was they weren't moving. That is not appropriate damages. The last thing I want to talk to is, of course, about the indemnification. Obviously, if we're not in breach of the contracts, there would be no indemnification. But indemnification, by its definition, applies when the party indemnified is sued, not when the party indemnified takes it upon its own self to make a poor mitigation decision and sue tenants and lose. So we do not believe that unless they prevailed against the tenants, that we should be stuck for their attorney's fees. I think it's clear that it's always discretionary with the court. There were victories on both sides, and I understand how Rule 54 and costs work. The court is free to assess because my client prevailed in the fraud claims and that no damages were awarded in the breach of contract and breach of warranty claims to say that neither side gets their attorney's fees as costs of this suit. But that is a different question than when the appellants make their own decision. Because again, basically what you're saying now is that when you sign, if you want to believe their argument, when you sign a contract with an indemnification agreement, they can go out and sue anybody and sue anybody and lose, and you're still stuck with the fees. That is a ridiculous position to take because you cannot, unless they prevailed on something, and they did not prevail on anything with the jars, because as the court knows, they've now settled with the jars. And settled with the jars, obviously the facts aren't before the court as to what was settled for, but to hold my client responsible for their poor decision in asserting claims against the jars, which they could not prevail on, under an indemnification clause, is not proper. Because otherwise, we're never protected. Any seller would have the same problem that signs an indemnification clause. If any buyer wanted to bring any piece of unwarranted, we'll call it litigation. And so for those reasons, Your Honor, we're asking to reverse the trial court as to the three issues of breach. We're asking to uphold the trial court if it doesn't reverse the trial court on the breaches as to the lack of any damages that were presented.
Mr. Fisher, I'm just curious as to go back to the first point that you made in your argument about the real estate purchase agreement and the warranty deed that referred to encumbrances and to a separate schedule that listed them. Why didn't anybody say, well, we recognize that there's a lease for the sports bar, let's add that to the attachment that mentioned encumbrances?
Well, the appellants did recognize and did tell the title company that there was an encumbrance out there. It was not added. And again, they were responsible, and it's clearly evidence in pursuant to the contract, is it should have been added. I don't think there's any question that had it been added, that would have been the easy thing. My client relied on his oral statement to say, I'm not closing unless you accept it. And their agreement to accept it by closing, when certainly the smarter method, and had he called our office, would have been to include it in the title policy as an exception. But as this court knows, contracts are acceptable even in spite of written contracts prohibiting the same in Colorado. And there is no question that that's what happened here. So whether it's a amendment to the contract or whether it's just a waiver, I don't think under either analysis it changes, Your Honor.
Well, but sort of a corollary to that that arises in my mind is that initially there was information that there was just a month-to-month tenancy, which also would have been an encumbrance on the property.
Correct.
But that wasn't mentioned either in the documents as they were originally drafted.
It wasn't, and it should have been, obviously, because any tenancy was a month-to-month obligation, and it should have been listed. And as all parties know, that it's an encumbrance in Colorado, whether it's a one-day lease or, in this case, lease for a term of years. So why it wasn't listed is unfortunate, because otherwise I don't think we're here at all. But again, I think it's a, I think it's the reason we're here is because neither party was as diligent in listing under the contract as they should have been. But I go back to the contract, which requires them to object to the comments they knew of from day one. And it is not in their objections at any point in time, Your Honor.
Okay. You argued waiver to the court, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Your client testified that they had somehow accepted the lease, or just that they knew about the lease? How did you argue waiver to the court, I guess?
The waiver was, Your Honor, is that 2 days before the closing, the lease was resubmitted to both sides. Our point was is that the appellants legally notified the title company, said, we're not closing. My client said, I'm not closing unless you accept the lease, and therefore, by their acceptance in closing, we think they waived their right to make their claim.
So did the trial court make a factual finding as to whether there was waiver or not?
Did not. I don't read its, ruling to address the issue of waiver. In fact, I think he just kind of slides over it, relying on downtown parking, which I think is factually different. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Mr. Fisher.
I have a few direct points to address. The first is with respect to Mr. Foster's testimony about whether the property could be redeveloped in phases. That's at page 2074 of his testimony, and he says, question at line 10, you indicated in your testimony that the lease on the property actually prevents it from being redeveloped until the lease term expires. Line 13, answer correct. So his testimony was, this bar property abuts Highway 34. It's the entrance to the property, and so you cannot redevelop around it, and that precludes it. The reason we're here is that Mr. Gary Grauman and Judge Lamon specifically found lied to the buyers. He said the tenants in the bar pay $2,800 per month. They're month to month, and there is no written lease. At that point in time, according to Judge Lamon's findings, there was a written lease. why lie? Look at Exhibit 38 itself. On its face, it is absolutely commercially unreasonable. It's got a copyright date of 2004, necessitating a hindsight explanation of why it's backdated to April 1st, 2003. All of the evidence in regards to why we're here and why my clients had every right to challenge the validity of that document when faced with what they believed was a fraud and a cram down of that lease upon them, they had every right to do, and they were not ridiculous in doing so, despite the fact that Judge Lammons did not agree with their evidence. Again, an encumbrance by definition diminishes a property's market value.
And Ms. Oldemeyer, again, what evidence is there in the record of diminished market value as opposed to cost to remove the tenant or anticipated profits from some future development? What evidence is there?
Mr. Randy Jackson, in his testimony, testified, this is an encumbrance. We did not get what we bargained for. Mr. Foster said, this is an encumbrance. It's a lease that precludes the redevelopment of the property. And the evidence in the record is, how do you remove the encumbrance? You relocate the tenant. You get them off the property.
You've conceded. You can do that if you've got a unilateral right to terminate the lease, or you've got a tenant who's willing to be bought out. But you, I mean, the position on appeal here, and I think it was in the trial court, is you've got a tenant who's not willing to leave, period.
Right.
So, again, we have to take the facts as they are, not in some vacuum wishing that, you know, how they were. So the facts that we have are a tenant who won't leave, can't be bought out. So that testimony seems to me is irrelevant. Okay? So just to say the property has been diminished in value isn't enough. You got to put a dollar figure on it, don't you?
Your Honor, if the tenant valued its leasehold interest as to the end of the term in 2015, and that dollar figure, the monthly rent, and we were awarded that as damages, we could go to the tenant, pay that to the tenant, and hopefully have the tenant vacate. An encumbrance, by definition, diminishes the market value of the property. We bargain for unencumbered property. We want the encumbrance removed. That's the evidence. Breach of contract, nominal damages at least, and then the consequential damages that we listed in our brief as well, the making keeping peace with the tenant, the fact that we had to sue to determine the validity of this lease. May I have one brief moment, Your Honor, to address the waiver?
I don't think so. I didn't allow the attorney in the previous case extra time, so I think to be consistent, that my answer is no. But
thank you
for your argument, Ms. Oldemeyer. Thank you, Mr. Fisher, as well. We appreciate both of your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.